What we've said in the report is, on the one hand, yes, societies like the US, the UK, many others, particularly developed economies, clearly are extremely dependent now on computers and the telecommunications facilities, the internet. That's only going to increase. And so anything that can damage that clearly is something governments do have to think about. At the same time, what we said is you read quite a bit in the media about the threats of cyber war. We think that it's only very well motivated, capable, resourced governments, again, such as the United States and its allies, that really have the ability to do that. We don't think that less developed countries, and particularly sub-state groups like terrorist groups, have the resources or really the motivation to launch these kind of crippling online attacks.
So I don't need to lose all the sleep. I can sleep a little bit.
I think you can certainly sleep for now. We've set out a whole range of ways that governments can make sure that situation remains the same, that they can protect critical computer infrastructures, the ones that are running things like water grids, power grids, and so on, because clearly if those go wrong, then there's potential for really serious harm.
And I want to go through a couple of those recommendations in a second, but the part that really, and I'll read from part of your report, catastrophic single cyber-related events could include, and you run through a number of them, we're talking about things like what?
We said there aren't so many of those, but some examples would be a massive solar radiation. You do get solar flares occasionally, which can cause serious damage to satellites and to communications facilities on the ground, potentially knock out ground stations.
Which, of course, is a naturally occurring event. You can't really do too much about that.
That's right. The more sort of attack one that people could worry about would be attacks on elements of the internet that are really pervasive. So for example, there are some companies. Cisco, for example, has a very large percentage of the market for the devices that carry internet data around the network. So if there was a vulnerability found in their routers, which was common right across a very large percentage of the internet, that might be a significant overall vulnerability of the internet. Similarly, we said if some of the protocols that internet computers use to talk to each other, there are some particular key ones, if there are security vulnerabilities found in those protocols, that might be a way for an attack to have quite a significant impact.
One of the things we've seen happen a lot in the past year is, and everyone's talking about the Stuxnet worm, where all of a sudden it's almost targeted attacks seeking to sort of aim at specific types of parts of the infrastructure. Is that something you think we're going to see more of?
That's right. I think Stuxnet is a really good example of a sort of very specific targeted attack here on Iran's nuclear facilities. It seems that it was basically the U.S. and the Israeli governments that were behind that, and they're showing what very capable governments can do. At the same time, of course, Stuxnet was targeted at a particular area of Iranian government technology. It didn't, I'm sure very deliberately, did not have wider effects. It didn't damage the Iranian people's lives on a broader basis. So what we said in the report again was, in general, yes, occasionally states do go to war, do get each other, but cyber attacks will be one part of that in future. We think it's less likely there will be pure cyber war. It might be that in the opening stages of a war between two states, they absolutely would use cyber attacks to try to gain some initial advantage. But we said that's only really likely in a typical war situation. It's not something we think will become common and pervasive outside those war situations.
And we saw that in people believe that Russia cyber attacked Georgia before they actually rolled in with a more traditional force.
That's right. But again, that demonstrates one of the difficulties, which is working out exactly who is behind any given attack. It's hard to trace attacks back to specific computers. Even if you do that, it's hard to show, well, who was actually in control of those computers at the time. It might not have been the owners of the computers. They might have been infected with malicious software and actually were under the control of someone else entirely.
Talk about some of the measures that governments should take, because your report just almost everything in there says this is something that the governments really have a unique charter to do.
Governments clearly control some critical systems themselves, not least their own military diplomatic intelligence systems, so they need to take care of those, and by and large they do. They need to work carefully with the private sector, because in countries such as the US and the UK, it's actually the private sector that's running much of the critical national infrastructure, the power grid, the water networks, and so on. So governments need to make sure the companies running those networks are taking good care of them. Those companies don't always have completely aligned incentives with government. Of course, those private companies ultimately are there to make profits for their shareholders. That's fair enough. That's capitalism. But governments need to make sure those companies are really taking good security care of the systems that they build.
And so what should government organizations be doing?
We've pointed to some good examples in the U.S. where the Department of Homeland Security has set up a whole range of government-private sector partnerships to work with key industry sectors on securing their networks. We pointed at the UK, where the government has set up a cross-government body called the Office of Cybersecurity to make sure all of government is thinking about these issues, not just the Department of Defense, the Department of Justice, the more traditional parts of government that would think about this. So those are two good examples of ways governments can be planning ahead and making things safer in the future.
And how important is that cross-organizational structure, thinking not individual organizations, but thinking across government?
We think that's really important. There's always a temptation, particularly that the defense departments in governments take a lead on this, because a lot of them do have the most expertise within government on security and on attack and defense in general. It's a very technologically complex area, so much of government won't have a sort of particular desire to get involved in this, but we've said that would be a mistake, because so much critical national infrastructure is in the private sector, is nothing to do with the armed forces. A broader cross-section of government needs to sit up and really be thinking about these issues.
One of the things you talk about is that governments, particularly if they work together, have incredible buying power, procurement power across to shape industries. And if they use that to further harden, further secure systems, applications, all those kinds of things, that could be very powerful all across the IT industry.
That's right. So in buying the software, the operating systems particularly, that are running government systems, in gradually driving up security standards, governments there are not just helping themselves, they're not just increasing the security then of their own systems. It also means that all of the businesses and the private individuals that are buying those products in turn get the benefit of increased security for themselves, and also reduce the opportunity for malicious software to take over their computers and to use those as a staging post then to launch attacks against other people.
You also talk about the need for more research, and you tick off a couple of areas. Internet protocols is one area, contingency planning, human factors, security, economics, and also risk analysis, which just seems to be one of the real difficult areas for folks to get their arms around.
That's right, and we've said there's been a lot of great computer security and cryptography research done over the last couple of decades. That side is pretty much sorted out now. It's the more organizational, people-centered, people-focused work that remains to be done, and there are fewer people doing that. It's perhaps a harder problem because it crosses disciplines. It's not just a computer science problem or a maths problem.
And so it does extend beyond just that traditional sort of computer science areas.
That's right. And that's something I think where agencies, if, for example, in the US, the National Security Agency, and the UK Government Communications Headquarters, which are very highly skilled on the more technical and mathematical cryptographic computer science side, perhaps haven't done so much in the past and perhaps could take a lead in moving into these newer areas.
How important is the need for people, for brain power? I know in the U.S., a lot of government organizations have trouble finding the best people for the best jobs. There aren't that many folks out there. How big of an issue is that for the defenders?
That is a big problem. We have seen in the last, probably since the dot-com crash, actually, at the start of the last decade, fewer young people going into degree programs, graduate programs in these areas. And then, of course, that means that government agencies trying to recruit people with those skills find that more difficult and perhaps are having to do more of the training themselves. So I think that's something that backs up the decision of many Western governments to keep a focus in higher education on the science, technology, engineering, and math subjects that will ultimately supply those people for them.
For folks who are going to spend some time reading this, and it's long, but it's very manageable, what's the one thing you hope they take away from it?
I hope people will see there's no need to panic in the short to medium term, at the same time, there are measures that government and industry should be taking now so that in 5 or 10 years' time, you and I could have this conversation and I could happily give them the same message at that point.